Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate Chief Information Officer. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So it's been almost 4 years since I had an IT representative. Back then, I think it was a CIO, but now obviously you're an associate CIO from USGS on my program. So there's a lot of older priorities to catch up on. So let's just start right there in the beginning. Back in 2013, USGS was using some new radar to collect data, new tools to make that data accessible. That was part of a big data strategy. Let's jump in and talk big data, because you guys, for the most part, really are a big data agency. So what tools are you using today? What tools are you going to use tomorrow? Give me a sense of where you guys stand with big data.
We have continued on that path with collection of data, and the radar in particular, let's update on that. The goal you discussed was our nationwide LIDAR laser detection and ranging technology, but we're also now using IFSAR, which is an interferometric synthetic aperture radar in Alaska, in order to collect three-dimensional geospatial information in Alaska. It's amazing the success we've had, and year by year we're continuing to build out data sets, especially in Alaska where the terrain and the data, the 3D data was so bad. The improvements for aeronautics and other activities on the ground has been tremendous. From my concentrations here in USGS are around cloud, continued interdisciplinary data collection using sensor technology that'll give us the framework for doing more detailed analytics and providing more detailed services to our many, many customers. We'll get into that later probably. The emphasis in DOI and USGS is the ability to take large data sets, synthesize those data, analyze, model, and produce data product that can service many uses. In the future, I hope to integrate our IT and data sciences more widely across Department of Interior, but also continue to work on relationships that we now have with NASA and NOAA, the USDA Forest Service, and others.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. There's a ton going on. So first of all, I think the 3D data sets, as you mentioned, and 3D imaging is one of those technologies that makes you feel like, hey, look, we're ahead of the game in many ways. The government sometimes gets a bad reputation of being behind. So talk a little bit more about the new 3D technology. I'm not going to try to re-pronounce the name you use, but it sounds pretty cool.
In a nutshell, 3DEP, we call it 3DEP, but three-dimensional elevation program, has been developed over a 8-year program in USGS. We are the lead civilian mapping agency, and our core science systems mission area staff is the managing partner for 3D data on behalf of the 18 federal agencies and countless state, local, tribal, and other partners. This is based on our National Enhanced Elevation Assessment that has documented more than 600 business uses of elevation data across 34 federal agencies in all 50 states. It also includes local government and other organizations. The 3DEP program itself generates about $13 billion a year in benefits through applications that span across multiple functional areas. For example, two of our top uses are flood risk management and infrastructure and construction management, which are actually big priorities of the new administration and the nation as a whole. So whether it's building bridges and roads to planning aviation navigation, they all depend on having high quality topographic information.
One of the things, let me jump in real quick, because I think one of the things about people don't get about what USGS does day in and day out is not just collect the data, they're providing it. I think the partnerships you mentioned, 34 federal agencies, all 50 states, and that includes the state and local government organizations. I imagine that's also where some of those tools, some of those ability, you mentioned the cloud, I know we'll probably talk more about that, but I imagine that's where this new rush of technology is making those things a little bit easier to share that information and to see what other applications can be built off the data that you guys collect.
As you said, cloud, there's a tremendous amount of work going on in making that information available via web services and for performance and for interoperability and price. We are moving that data into the cloud. We've moved a lot of it already into the cloud. So let me start with cloud, because there's a number of different ways to describe what we're doing with that data. So if you back to the Federal Geographic Data Committee, and USGS is a managing partner of that, they identified 140 different data sets of importance to the nation, if you will. And those data sets are stored in many locations, but using the DOI cloud contract at the department, a geospatial platform was built. Those 140 data sets can be accessed through that geo platform. USGS and much of our data is also published into that platform and is also made available through data.gov.
Tim, you bring up the cloud. Obviously, the cloud brings so many benefits, as you said, making those 140 data sets available to anyone at any time. But cloud also is beneficial because of the volume. And I can only imagine the volume of data is ever increasing. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in that realm.
First of all, we're publishing through data.gov, and we've been one of the largest contributors to data.gov. And the way this works in USGS, we have our science data catalog. That's our internal data store, and that has over 8,000 USGS data sets and associated services with fully documented metadata. We publish that to data.gov. So in data.gov, we have over 6,000 data sets, but some of those are very large collections, if you will. For example, we talked earlier about the 3DEP LIDAR point data. We have 936,000 LIDAR point data sets, and some of those individual data sets actually have millions of points in it. So right now we have over 5 trillion LIDAR points, and that's growing very rapidly. If we look at the digital elevation models data, we have 6,000 DEM models and 130,000 topographic maps also in data.gov. So again, across government, we're one of the largest contributors to data.gov. These data sets are just, continue to grow and grow. If we look at the Landsat data that is downloaded by Google and many, many others for a whole variety of use, that's our land satellite data program that's been going on for 50 years in USGS. We have, in spinning disk, we have 30 petabytes and another 20 petabytes in nearby storage, and those data sets are growing and growing every day as well.
And actually, that was my next question, is when you talk about, because we usually talk about storage in petabytes, and we mentioned about 50 petabytes total, but it's probably much more than that. And then you also brought up the sensors piece, which is the whole Internet of Things. How are you guys preparing for this, what will be and what is this incredible growth of data?
We have some serious work to do in terms of data strategy and data management. We do have an active program trying to meet the Trusted Digital Repository effort. We can talk about that. But probably more importantly is this just ongoing storage dilemma. We were well over 100 petabytes of data, which is a lot of more zeros than I can count, in USGS, and continue to add storage to consolidated data centers. You talked about, you mentioned sensors, but we're continuing to, you know, we have 8,000 water gauges. We have, you know, the earthquake sensors, Northern California, Southern California, Caribbean, Alaska, et cetera, the sensor networks. Those data, those continue to generate a lot of data. And we expect over time, as do many organizations, with the increased innovation and miniaturization, that those data sets are going to continue to get larger and larger as we deploy additional sensors. A new area of that, of data explosion, is in the bioinformatics arena, or DNA. We collect something called environmental DNA. That could be a water sample, a soil sample, and we're analyzing the entire biological content of that sample, and there might be 30 or 40 different bacteria species, you know, in that one sample. A water sample can give us 10 or 20 different fish species and other things living in that water or dropping DNA into that water. So little bits of data runs with those can generate terabytes of data. So the bottom line is storage. We're modernizing our storage. We're increasing our storage capability. And we're working on, with our cloud partners, on storage gateways and different storage strategies for both dark archive and more readily accessible nearline data in the cloud in order to manage costs.
But let's take a quick break, and we come back, we can jump into some of those other older priorities that maybe are data related. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate CIO. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate Chief Information Officer. Now, Tim, before break, we talked a ton about data and all the cool things you guys are doing with data. And one of the things that people have to understand about what you do with data is how much of this is based on the mission of USGS and how much data comes from that mission. So let's start with that question for this segment and talk a little bit about how are you supporting all that mission data.
Let me give you a rundown of those missions. If we look at our hazards mission, we're looking at primarily earthquake and volcano data. We have extensive networks for seismic networks. There's the Northern California, Southern California, Caribbean, and Alaskan seismic networks, which are bringing data back in real time from these hundreds of sensors and processing those. Let's talk a little later about innovations, because I want to talk more about earthquakes and one of our more exciting mobile applications in that area. But let me move on. In the water science area, we have over 8,000 stream gauges, plus we collect a lot of data from additional sources, but that is the nation's primary stream information. So whether you're a fisherman or a kayaker or a municipality that's worried about the rising water in your front yard, that National Water Information System is a very important resource. In the minerals and energy area, we provide much of the data on the nation's minerals. And so one of the jokes I like to make is a lot of people are, you know, people would say, so what are you using in terms of your mobile applications for your mineral database? And I say, well, I'll tell you what, here's what our minerals database helps in terms of maintaining your mobile devices, because many of those minerals we keep track of are actually what are required in order to build a mobile device. So a little spin on the mobile mobile device story.
The question is how many people get the joke, right? They probably don't realize what goes
Nobody
in their iPhone.
The joke.
Exactly.
It's a total nerd joke.
Exactly, but it's okay.
So in the climate and land use area, we've got the first civilian application of the United States satellite program. In conjunction with NASA, we built the Earth Resource Observation Center up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and that is the AROS Data Center for short, and that's the Landsat data we talked about earlier about the massive amounts of storage. What's interesting is that data is downloaded, incredible amount of downloads, and then what many companies do is they build tertiary products after downloading and massaging our data. If we look at environmental health, we're looking, we collect data on and do fundamental research on the land itself. So whether it's pollutants, biologicals, or what, we're looking at invasive species would be a good example. We're concerned about things in the environment that can threaten humans, like land snails, the West African land snails, and the diseases they bring in, and many, many, many other cases. The threats of invasive species to our economy. So if you look at the economy of the Great Lakes, the hundreds of millions of dollars of, you know, fishing, recreation, et cetera, and what happens when if the commercial fishing and the sport fishing industries of the Great Lakes were taken over by lampreys or Asian carp or other types of invasive species. That's like playing an electronic first-person shooter game where you're trying to, you know, on a grand scale of trying to block invasive species from entering stream systems or environments. So we have quite a broad set of missions in USGS that in almost every way are data-driven. And the level of sophistication of science has become, you know, big data, many, many applications. It's gotten to where our scientists are incredibly good at understanding how to, whether it's write code or analyze data. You know, you have to be a statistician almost anymore in order to formulate a research project. It's not yesterday's science. It's really even a brand new world in terms of how science is conducted because it is so data-driven. And even the code itself, if you're going to publish science, the code itself really needs to be part of that in order to reproduce the science and in order for you to validate that that science has been done correctly. So it's a very IT-driven science world we live in.
Tim, one thing that comes to mind as you're talking about the scientists and IT-driven world, what kind of tools or what are you looking at or you hope to give these scientists? Because the tools are changing, the visualization tools and the ability to visualize and make decisions based on those data sets and those data tools. Are you guys looking for specific new tools?
This is what's remarkable. The scientists, many of them are PhDs, are working very closely with partners and universities. And so they're at the cutting edge of tool development and use of tools. I was at a meeting not too long ago, and one of our scientists was talking to other scientists and basically saying, if you don't know how to write code, you're probably functionally illiterate in the lab, because so much of the work and just running the instrumentation requires the ability to modify the functioning of the device, and that is often done by changing code. In terms of tools, we're using very large models for synthesizing data of different types, analyzing data, developing hydro models. You know, for instance, if you're looking at a volcano plume traveling across the United States over our sky. That's actually a hydrologic model. It's just not in water, right? But tracking the density of that cloud, you know, the elevation range of that cloud, how it interacts with the wind can be incredibly important for airplanes, as an example. But it's a constant discovery process of what tools come in. It's almost indescribable in terms of the mission-by-mission area that scientists use. If it's the genetics community, it's an array of cutting-edge scientific bioinformatics tools. And whether the tools came out of NIH or out of a university or something that another country, that array of tools changes almost daily. So we're starting to move our bioinformatics community into the cloud. And there's an array of, I think it was last I saw, 460 different bioinformatics tools that we were going to make accessible to our genetics community. Those are just the cloud ones. We use some additional ones. But the ability to look at national databases, whether that's put up there by NIH or others, and the ability to make discoveries, even in the medical area, is a very data-driven, very tool-oriented process. So let me get specific on a bioinformatic tool. We have one called BLAST. We compare databases. So our Leetown Science Center, as an example, was doing research on white suckers in the Great Lakes. And what they discovered by comparing their data from a gene sequencing run of something they found in a white sucker, and they said, well, we don't recognize what this is. It's something living in the white sucker. They compared it to these national databases, and lo and behold, they came up with a whole new strain of hepatitis B. And that is of great interest to the virology world. But that's a perfect example of big data management, the ability to mash up data sets across agencies and make a fundamental contribution to the world, because now there's more information about hepatitis B, and potentially, because genetically this was an older strain, meaning the newer strains that are in humans and birds are genetically younger. This was actually fundamentally an older strain. Now there's more information about hepatitis B, and perhaps we can even contribute to the medical virology world in coming up with solutions for hep B.
Very interesting. I think that's a fascinating example of not just the data, but then how the tools that you can provide to help understand the data. And one of the key pieces of all of this is making sure those tools, then that data is trusted. And you mentioned a program earlier on, the Trusted Digital Repository Program. Talk a little bit about what that program does and how that relates back to everything you've just been describing.
That's critical to data management, and trust on data and trust on science is everything. So we've come up with a new system. This is a USGS-built system. And it's called ScienceBase. And we use it to provide, it's an internal system used by USGS scientists to provide discovery, access, and use of our science project data. So this project data is the actual data collected in the course of doing the scientific work, whether it's sampled in the field or in a lab, and the metadata with that associated data. It uses web services, APIs, and spatial services to drive data access and integrate with applications in a fairly elaborate publication workflow, if you will. So ScienceBase is on the cusp of completing designation as a trusted digital repository. And the platform provides very reliable, permission-controlled access to the data services and data sets I I mentioned earlier.
Tim, fascinating examples, a lot of going on around data. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can jump into some newer priorities, if you will, some maybe non-data related priorities, if that's even possible. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate CIO. Now, Tim, we spent the first part of the program talking a lot about data and some older priorities and getting updates on how you're doing. Ton of great information about data, but I'm just going to guess here, you may have some other priorities you're working on. Talk about other things you're trying to get done over the next 6 or 9 months.
One of my key program areas is cloud implementation, as many other agencies in government are engaged in the same. But we, USGS, is a very active and maturing cloud hosting program where we're continuing to work on improving our processes. At the same time, in the department's cloud, we've onboarded probably 12 or 14 USGS applications, and then in using a NIH contract, we've added about another 10 or 12 applications into cloud services. But internally, we're trying to build the capability of having very robust network security, access authentication services wrapped around our cloud service, a very capable business operation in terms of ordering and billing cloud services using agile DevOps methodologies in order to ease the onboarding. But I think what's exciting for me is we're looking at the whole approach of building the front end and making it so solid and secure that a customer could actually do what I call self-service onboarding. So using an array of tools, and I don't want to use any names here, but there's an array of tools that as we structure those for our customers with relatively little assistance, they then can move a cloud application into our pipeline and get it onboarded quickly. The problem with some of our earlier efforts in USGS is it took a fair amount of handholding to bring that customer along and into the cloud, and therefore it slowed the pace at which we could bring more customers in the cloud. But I think we're about ready to turn a corner in this whole self-service onboarding area. Another area we're looking at is some pretty exciting applications. So one we're starting conversation on is earthquake early warning system. And what earthquake early warning is, we're actually testing it in Southern California, so unfortunately we're going to get back to talking about data here, is let's say there's an earthquake in the Salton Sea in Southern California, which is 80 miles or from Los Angeles. And let's say you're in L.A. and you have your smartphone with you, and you are one of these smart people, Jason, and you picked up and downloaded our earthquake early warning system on your smartphone. The big 8.0 earthquake hits in the Salton Sea, and your smartphone goes off, and you get this big red screen, and it starts ticking down, 20, 19, 18, 17. So what's happened behind the scenes is the earthquake sensors pick up the waves. They transmit it to our processing. It gets analyzed and then triggers the earthquake early warning system broadcasting out over the networks, wireless networks, to subscribers. And the subscriber gets a screen that shows the potential severity, and the processing is done fairly quickly. So it's not, you know, whether it's a 7.8 or an 8.0, you know, there's probably a fair amount of error in there. But it's not going to be a 2. It's a big one. So if in that scenario, you're not going to have that much error. It's already been tested fairly well. But what does that give you? So if let's pick the Bay Area. If it's Bay Area Rapid Transit System, those trains can slow down 3 miles per hour per second. If you have 20 seconds, that's 60 miles an hour. If you're emergency management, and let's say your fire station, and you subscribe to this service, you could have all the doors on all your fire stations open up, you know, in that 5 to 10 second range. If you're in a hospital doing eye surgery on someone and you have 20 seconds, you know, a doctor can, to a certain extent, secure the operating environment a little bit. Elevators, buildings that subscribe to these services, building management companies, could have all their elevators go to the nearest floor and open. So this is it's an exciting application. We want to take advantage of the reliability and the speed of cloud services, because in an application like this, every millisecond counts. So that's one example. We're doing also in cloud, we're doing a web reengineering initiative, or RET. We like to call it RET. And so we're taking about 150 of our USGS websites that were pretty independent, you know, sort of organically grown over the years, and we're running them through a common look and feel project and then hosting that also in the cloud. And again, you get the advantages of cloud in terms of cost, security, and performance. That's a couple of the things that are exciting. We have some applications that have been in there for a while, and we're seeing really significant use. One of our digital services that we're using in the cloud is the National Map. And this is a great example because by putting it in the cloud, we saw the usage go up. So the National Map is a public, provides the public with online, interactive, downloadable topographic data and other kinds of data. So historic topo maps. You want that 100-year-old USGS topographic map of your favorite mountain or something. Current US topo, that 3D elevation data we talked about earlier, water, land cover, structures, transportation, boundaries, all sorts of things. And what we have seen is we're getting literally millions of downloads per month by the public. When we moved to the cloud, the usage jumped up tremendously, but also the performance. So the worst case we had was a file that took 120 seconds. We benchmarked this file. Doing it internally, it took someone, an external user, 120 seconds to download this file. When we moved it to the cloud, it was done in 1.8 seconds. So that, for the public, not only was that performance great, but also if they wanted to now download 4 other maps, that became a lot less painful. So those are some, I guess, range of some of the things we're doing in the cloud. We're also working very closely with our bioinformatics community. We've surveyed them to try to organize how we want to approach, test, and bring that community of interest into the cloud.
That's a great example. I think both the 3D data that you're talking about, the National Map data. Let me ask you, cloud plays a role also in mobility, also plays a role in some of the other things. Are you guys starting to move into the mobility area? Are you starting to look at ways to ensure that interior employees and others have access to your data from a mobile platform?
Our web reengineering effort was built around mobile applications in mind. So we start with, you know, what is that page going to look like from a mobile platform. And then as we move up to where you're getting a full screen, what other things are we going to add in? So that was a ground, from the ground up, purposeful design around mobility. We're building many of our scientific applications are being ported over to mobile platforms because our scientists in the field want to do more of their science in the field. In fact, because of mobility, and this is really interesting, we have a group called our Strategic Laboratories Committee, and they're looking at how do we manage labs and fundamentally what is a lab. Now, most people think of this little room with vents and instruments and somebody walking around in a white coat. But we've really come to the conclusion that because of mobility and because of networks that are much better, the lab has really extended into the field. If you look at nanotechnology, improvement of instrumentation, scientific processes that were previously done only in a lab can now be done out in the field, to where we can do things like early detection of certain DNA prints. So if you want to know if Asian carp have entered some reach of the Mississippi River or the Illinois River, we have this early detection eDNA kit that you can take out in the field with you and immediately find the presence of that species just by taking a water sample. So mobility is huge for science. It's the future of science. It literally has changed the world of science.
Tim, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into that last segment and talk about some other things. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate CIO. Now, Tim, before break, we talked a lot about your new priorities. We talked a lot about cloud and mobility. Related to that is shared services. I know, for instance, you mentioned earlier that the Interior Department is providing some cloud platforms, some cloud services. They have a big cloud contract. But shared services also is creeping in around other areas, too. So talk a little bit about how USGS is taking advantage of shared services.
We're actually working very close with the department and with the other bureaus in the department to parse up the tremendous IT workload that exists within the department. So I think we hit cloud pretty hard, but that's one area where we're collaborating with the department. One area that's prime importance and we're really seeing growing in terms of shared services is advanced research computing. And when I say advanced research computing, I'm meaning what we call high throughput computing, so processing a lot of parallel data sets at the same time, and then high-performance computing, where we're doing big modeling for, big science covering large landscape areas. So this is a capacity that provides scientists with the ability to expand their area of study by running large jobs in much shorter time frames. I hear scientists talking about trying to run on their desktop computer some model, and it's literally going to take months. And instead, what they do is they work with our advanced research computing group, and they are trained. First of all, we have experts that help that scientist understand how to structure their data and structure their code to take full advantage of having many parallel core processors. We have a system in Denver. We call it YETI. It's a wonderful name, but it's a high-performance computing platform, and it has recently hit its 2 millionth job in, 2.5 years of operation. We also work in partnership with Oak Ridge National Lab, They have Titan. I don't know if you've ever heard of Titan, but it's the second largest computer in the world. And we're working with a much larger consortium called the Extreme Science and Engineering Discovery Environment, and that is many university and research institutions across the United States are leveraging capability. Like big data, with big data, it takes big processing in order to do that. So this service, Advanced Research Computing, we have now three or four different bureaus within DOI that are starting to use that.
Very interesting. I think high-performance computing, and as you said, you know, is becoming more important as the data sets grow. And we talked about how much data you guys are collecting every day. And again, it goes back to the Internet of Things as well. One other shared service that maybe doesn't fall into the internal category, but I know you also are doing a lot with the GSA's NS 2020 EIS procurement for new telecommunications. Talk about your role in leading that effort for the Interior Department.
Frankly, we're delighted to work with the GSA team. There's been meetings virtually every week with them. I am the exec sponsor for EIS transition for Department of Interior, so I have to wear a second hat there in terms of my working relationship with the department. But we've taken a kind of an interesting approach to that in that recently we awarded a broadband contract for cable, DSL, fiber optic service, and other types of broadband services using the networks contract. And the logic behind that was, let's start the transition ahead of time. Broadband, those services, those specific services were not offered under networks, and working with GSA, we were able to, I would say, move the marketplace. GSA was actually very collaborative, very cooperative, and helped us with this. And it, to me, it gives us that start even to the negotiations for the future contract. The other thing we've done is, and we haven't used it a whole lot up to now, but has taken advantage of the carrier Ethernet line items on the contract and are making moves to that, and very pleased to see that sort of generated, I would say, some competition in the marketplace. So the question always comes up in EIS, you know, are you just going to do a like-for-like transition, or are you going to try to do a transformation as you transition? And I would say we're actually doing more of an evolutionary approach, and we started our transformation before we even moved into this new contract.
Tim, there's so much more to cover, and we could talk so much longer, but unfortunately, I think we're out of time for today. So this has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank my guest, Tim Quinn, the Interior Department's U.S. Geological Survey's Associate Chief Information Officer. Tim, thanks for taking the time today.
Jason, I really enjoyed this.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.